was Doug, right? Hi, Doug.
Yes, hi.
Yes, well, why don't we start with this question then? Can you hear me okay? The sound is all right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's see. We are on verse 14.
We had, let's see what we finished. We did 15 as well last week. Yeah, we did 14 and 15 last week.
Okay, let me see if I can. We'd be starting with 16. He was reading the Sforno, and I'll apologize in advance if I am misquoting him, but he found something that indicated that it sounded like the Sforno was saying, and it might have been in a different reference, but somehow related to this, that the peoples of the earth, let's see, that the peoples of the earth who were hard on Israel are called to account for it because God essentially said, you know, I'm upset with you, but you guys punished them twice as much. And so that got us into a discussion of punishment, and what it appears to suggest is that the Sforno takes the position that punishment can occur to you when you don't know that it's happening. And I had a philosophical problem with that, because if the purpose of punishment, the only purpose of punishment that I can discern in a Torah framework is to change behavior. And if someone gets punishment at a later point in time from when they did whatever they did that's prompting the punishment, and they don't see the connection, then it would seem that the punishment is worthless because it doesn't end up changing the behavior because the person doesn't even connect it with that.
Okay.
That was where we left.
What was his source that a person can receive punishment and not know it?
Yeah, it was.
Was he saying?
Oh, he told me too. I think it was maybe in the prophets. At first I was led to believe it was Sforno on this verse, but I don't think so. I'm just looking, although I just have the Judaica edition, and it has very abbreviated Sforno. And I take it that in the Sforno that you have, that whole issue isn't brought up on these verses.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, then I'll have to get back to him and try to recall what the source is. I did not write that down, but he had a source.
Okay.
So I will make a note to do that. Just out of curiosity, is that also your understanding about the purpose of punishment?
Yeah, there's actually a verse that backs you up, Doug. The verse says, those who God loves, does he punish? What does that mean, those who he loves? It means those who will heed the punishment. Otherwise, there'll be a problem of God doing something which is futile, and God does not do anything which is futile. So if punishment would be meted out to somebody who pays no attention to it and is oblivious to it, that would be a futile thing.
So then I think his argument is that there is a source which I will try to get where the Sforno says that the nations are called to account because they punished Israel more than God wanted them to.
Now keep in mind, it could be that negativity is administered to a person or people other than for punishment. Can you think of a reason?
Negativity is
administered to a person or peoples even for another reason than punishment. Meaning the punishment we're
talking about. Well, the first one that comes to mind is personal growth. To allow them to see an error that they're making, that almost seems like punishment.
Right. That wouldn't be just.
Negative.
Like, for example, you could have God destroying all the people in the flood. So the babies are getting killed in the flood. So you can't tell me that's punishment.
Okay.
And same thing with the Amalekites, you know, today's Purim. And the victory over the Haman the Russia, the wicked person, the descendant of Amalek, who is actually the grandson of Isaac, I believe it was. The grandson of Esav, excuse me. Amalek was the grandson of Esav. Esav was the son of Isaac.
So then we're talking about God actually doing it as a benefit. Because, for example, say God took away a person's life. Well, this was the case with, I believe it's Enoch, where the presumption is if you live any longer, you're going to go downhill, so I'll end your life now as a benefit to you.
Yeah, that was Hanukkah, I think, last week? Who was that? We mentioned that last week, right.
Yeah, that was.
Right. You could have another reason, too. And, you know, keep in mind, this is a very important lesson that we'll come away with today. Like, for example, where he says here that in 16, or in 8:16, he says, okay, when I placed my heart to know with wisdom and to see the matter that is performed on the land, even day and night, sleep, my eyes didn't have. My eyes didn't see any sleep. And he says in 17, and then he continues, and I have seen. So it's a continuation, and I, you know, and means it's a continuation. And I've seen all of the matter that God has done, because, and for man cannot find the matter. I mean, he can't give an explanation, which is performed under the sun. On account of the man will seek out, and he will not find answers. And also a person might say, a wise man might say, I'll know something, but he can't find it out either. So you see, King Solomon is telling you that the matter is very expansive, and it's beyond the scope of man's abilities. Because he repeats in 17, man cannot figure out the matter. And if man tries to search it out. So we have to realize, you know, being that, again, King Solomon, we have to have the appreciation because he was the second wisest man ever, second to Moses. And again, he was given miraculous wisdom overnight at the age of 12. And at that point forward, the nation was astounded at his brilliance. And if this is a man who's saying that he spent day and night and didn't allow sleep to his eyes because he was trying to understand the matter. And what is the matter? Like Ibn Ezra said previously, that these next 16 verses are all about the matter of the good and the evil and how they're getting, seems to be similar type of experiences. You don't have like a rule that you can really, you know, fix. Because you see the wicked sometimes have great lives like the righteous people. You see the righteous people sometimes have devastating lives like that should be delivered to the evil people. And just one thing which occurs to me is that let's say every single time a good person did something good and the wicked people did something bad, they were met 100% of the time, according to human assessment, they would meet with a fate that's befitting. So that might have a certain effect on people that would remove them from doing something for the good itself. Meaning, you know, let's say every single time a person put his hand out to eat something not kosher, he would get zapped by some sort of a electronic impulse. You know, a couple of times he would just stop doing it, but not because he sees anything negative about violating the laws of kosher. So you see one thing right away that, and this apparently is by design, that this matter was even something which couldn't be figured out. And Rashi says this was the whole matter that Job, the book of Job, is about. That it says he was a tzaddik. He was a righteous person. Yet, the matter was something far from him. And he admitted that at the end of the book, that he couldn't really, even though he had complaints against God's justice, eventually he recognized that, just like Elihu told them, you can't figure out the physical world, and that's beyond your comprehension. How are you going to talk about things that are metaphysical, meaning laws of justice and how God operates? But despite all that, you see the King Solomon does say in 17, that I've seen the whole matter that God has done. So evidently everything is done with strict justice. And Maimonides says this in the Guide to the Perplexed. It's just beyond man's ability to comprehend what that justice is. But God is not oblivious to anything, and everything is done with justice. But there's, you know, the one primary factor here is that we're just mortal. And it is, you see, something which King Solomon spends a lot of the latter part of this book, Kehelet, on. And he's spending, according to Ibn Ezra, 16 verses. And you'll see he'll describe the opinions that people have and what the real problems are and what causes people to take issue. But I would say the rule that we have to keep in mind is if something you see is a good, so you have to follow it. You know that to leave somebody who's hungry without any food is a wrong thing. You understand that. It's a very easy thing to comprehend. And sometimes you'll see, well, the person is very righteous who doesn't have food. Then it starts to disturb you because it doesn't fit into your abilities. But you see that's what 17 is saying, that people are trying to search out and get the answer. They will seek it out, and they will not find the answer. And even wise men will try to understand this, but they can't find the end of the matter. Why can't they find the end of the matter?
Presumably because they would have to be God in order to understand it.
Okay, true. But practically, why couldn't they find the end of the matter? What were they faced with?
I wonder if it's because our emotions prevent us from seeing everything.
Well, what about King Solomon? He was the most objective and brilliant thinker. Well, what gave birth to the questions?
What ones I'm asking? No.
The whole series that, you know, about the wicked people have it good and the righteous people have it bad. I mean, it's basically the assumption of how justice should work, and the fact that the cases oppose our assessment. So the cases that we find, and that's exactly what King Solomon wrote about that we spoke last week, that we find some righteous people that are met with the fate of the wicked, and we find wicked people that are met with the fate of the righteous. I mean, the cases don't line up. I'm not saying all cases. We're just saying we find certain cases which, you know, they leave us with big questions. Go ahead, somebody had a question?
Rabbi, isn't it true that each case is different and it's too profound for us to understand? Only Hashem could understand, and when he doles out whatever he doles out, it's in balance with the person, each individual.
Well, yeah, of course. Okay. Exactly. Like I quoted Maimonides, everything is done with strict justice. And God is not oblivious to anything.
Right.
So can I ask two, I guess, related questions?
Sure, go ahead.
What is Maimonides' proof? Because the difficulty with that answer is that it seems like it's unprovable. You just sort of write everything off and say, well, God knows. And, I mean, I can understand that we may deduce that from the Torah, but we don't have any other practical proof for that idea, do we?
That what? That God knows everything?
Well, that everything is handled in accordance with strict justice. So if we see the you know, the little child get killed in the tsunami, or the righteous, seemingly righteous person has something happen to them or whatever, that all we can presume is God must have a reason.
No, but that's based on, again, if the Creator must know what He created, that I think is clear to everybody. So He's not oblivious to any creature that He made, any soul that He fashioned. So that's why the you know, all the rabbis in unison accept that God is aware of everything that happens to every single person. It's amazing, it's, you know, mind-boggling to us, that amount of numbers, but if He could make that many, those billions, tens, twenties, 30 billion people that have ever stepped foot on earth till today, if He could create them, then He has to know what He created. So that makes sense. But then also, what about the justice? So always we have to look, we have to examine, we have to be honest and examine what we've seen him do. And from the justice of how all of the environmental needs are there for every species without man's involvement of extinction, and the climates predominantly on Earth are very inhabitable by all the species, man, animals, everything, insects. The way that these things sustain themselves in terms of digestion, moisture, respiratory, circulatory, all the different systems. The fact that there's something called intelligence given to one species, that it can harness all the elements and create livable habitation to the point that, you know, what we have today, the kings 100 years ago didn't have. Right, the lowest person today is living better than the kings back then. And that's just talking about creation and how things interact natural in the natural world. But then if you start studying the Torah and history, and you see even in terms of the whole story of Purim, how things were set up perfectly time-wise, that the wisdom that was given to Esther through God's own wisdom, that he gave human beings wisdom, she understood that, as Rabbi Chait explained, to create this, she couldn't just come right out and accuse Haman, who was a second in command, because she had to start getting Ahasuerus, the king, to be suspicious. Only when there's some suspicion, then that opens the door for her to make the claim that he's trying to destroy my people. And then he would act on it. So she had to make him suspicious, so she invites him to one party. And he says, ask what you want, Esther, and up to half of the kingdom I'll give you. So she says, if it pleases the king and Haman, you should come to a party I'll make again tomorrow night. So why didn't she just tell him what her request was then and there? You see what happened. It says right after that party was over, then that night the king couldn't sleep. So Esther's plan started to take root. And what happened? He said, bring me the book of remembrances and start reading it to me. And another thing happens. And then they just start reading about Mordechai. The book must have been very large. Why is it that they just happened to turn to that page? Another apparent act of providence. And he asked what happened to Mordechai, because Mordechai happened to have heard about Bigson and Seresh. They plotted to kill the king. How did it happen that Mordechai, just to be at the right place at the right time, that he heard about this plot? The kingdom was big. Shushan, the capital. I mean, again, another point of providence is being told to you in the story. That he just happened to be at the right place, he heard about, and he also knew the languages that they were speaking, and reported, and it happens to be that night, when the king starts getting suspicious, and that's why he can't sleep, because he's wondering what Esther's next party is about. So then, at that very moment, he asks to be read the book of Zechronos, the remembrance book, and they tell him specifically that case. Again, like I said, God's providence. And what happens again at that very moment? Somebody's in the courtyard of the king, in the middle of the night. And who is it? It's Haman. And he's coming with the advice of his wife. She said, go in the morning. And if he couldn't stand the fact that Mordechai would never stand up for him, and it bothered him so much, so go to the king. Go to the king and he'll kill you. You know, he'll kill Mordechai for you. So he couldn't wait. He was too impulsive. So he went in the middle of the night. And that was the very moment that the king had just read about the great Mordechai who saved his life. And now Haman is in the courtyard. And why is he there? Because he wants to hang Mordechai. So now he starts asking Haman, what should the king do to the person who he wants to give honor to? Of course, Haman thought it was him. So he talks about that he should give the king's horse and the king's crown and parade him around the city. So the king started seeing, Haman is just, this guy Haman, he's just after the throne. And then what seals the fate? The next day at the party, after he couldn't sleep and he's bothered, he's already leaning towards certain suspicion with Haman. So that's when Esther popped the news and said that Haman is the one that's out to kill my people. And she was, king was like disturbed, and he went out to the porch, and the major says that he looked out. It's a metaphor that the rabbis wrote, and he said he saw that Haman's angels were plucking up trees from the kingdom, or there are angels, there are these things that were pulling up the trees from his kingdom, meaning he saw that his kingdom was now in threat. Because he said, this guy Haman, he's now putting two and two together. He wanted to be paraded with the throne, and the guy was just so impulsive that he couldn't even hold his mouth back. He should have been very discreet when the king asked him, what should the king do, the one he wants to honor? He shouldn't have blurted out. He should put a crown on his head. He revealed. He showed his true colors. So the king is in a frenzy. He can't stand the fact that this beautiful wife that he married, and now Haman is trying to kill the people. So he walks back into the wine party and he finds Haman is on the queen's bed, is on Esther's bed. He fell on the bed. The Medrash says that angels had pushed him on the bed. Evidently, he was again he lost his control. He knew that his life was now just on a hanging by a thread. So he was pleading for his life from Esther, and he didn't watch himself, and he went on her bed in order to approach her. And what does the king say when he comes back in from trying to cool off on the porch? He comes back in and he sees Haman on Queen Esther's bed. He says, "You're going to conquer the queen while I'm still in the palace?" So then that was it. That was curtains for him. But you see the timing. So I'm just illustrating all this to show you how not only is the natural world designed in such a way where you see great justice in terms of how God creates the species and temperature and food and everything that's so pleasing and perfect for the life of all the species, but you see in terms of how he works with people who are intelligent, and that's what Esther and Mordechai personified, was great intelligence. And they didn't just jump like a Haman who was impulsive, but they waited and they thought of a plan, and Esther used her cunning and understood how psychology works and how I can't just come right out, I have to make him suspicious. And it worked. He couldn't sleep that night. But then God stepped in and worked with his providence in accordance with the wisdom that Mordechai and Esther had commenced. So you see how God worked with those who were wise. And he will, and there's the justice. There's another beautiful example. All those examples of the providence, and this is not limited just to the story of Mordechai and Esther, and it's not limited just to that one chapter, but throughout the whole Megillah, you'll see this if you study it. But you have it in the entire Torah, the justice, and the flood, and Lot, who was saved, and his wife, who was punished, and God was trying to talk, Cain out of killing his brother, and all the great plagues that were visited to the Egyptians, and how the plagues were very specifically designed to the nature of the personalities. And Moses says, "But a plague of hail that the wheat and the wheat and the spelt, I'm not sure which one, there were stiff plants. The wheat and the barley were broken before the hail because they were stiff. But the flax and the spelt, they ripened later, so they were still very soft. They didn't harden yet. So he says those didn't break with the hail. So why was Moses telling this to Paro? To show him that God gave a plague that embodied a lesson to Paro. And he's trying to show Paro that if you're stubborn and stiff, like certain type of plants, you're going to break. If you show flexibility before God, like these other plants, then you could bend and then you'll survive all of this. So even, not only the plagues, but the messages that Moses saw in the design of the plagues. So the depths of God's wisdom are there and the justice is there. So it's a long answer, but I think, you see, it illustrates the point. And it's not that we'll be fortunate to see the wisdom in every case, but if this is all we see, a continuous, instances of justice in the natural world and the world of human affairs and justice, this is why we say that God is just. So getting back to you, Doug, so yes, God is aware of everything because he created everything, and he has to be aware of what he creates. It's impossible to create something and not be aware of it. By definition, you're aware of something you create. But then when we see all these cases in the history and we understand how God worked in these cases, specifically by Purim, so we're aware of the great justice and care that he shows to his creatures. So that's why we say it's that he's just. But then at the same time, you have to read King Solomon. And the matter is very expansive. And even though he spent his nights and he didn't let any sleep to his eyes, he still could not come away with the answer. And those who searched out after it And those who try to ponder it, to think into it, the matter is just beyond man's scope. Because we're man, we're human. So we won't be able to get all the answers. But there is justice. And you see, because he's saying, King Solomon's saying in 17, I've seen all the matter that God, but he uses the term judge. God in terms of judge. Elohim. That means a judge. So he says, I've seen all the matters that God has done. So that means that there is justice in everything. Whether man can see it in every case, like Maimonides says, you can't. But you can't use we can't use our feeble minds as a barometer as to whether we're making a determination is God just or not. A person has to take a look. I mean, would Einstein say that he could really make an assessment about God? I mean, I was just reading a quote from him, and he talks about how his religion is one where he sees an amazing spirit behind all of what he sees in the heavens and the earth, and that our feeble minds can just see a portion of it. So he says two things, that he sees it, he knows he's just scratching the surface, but he sees the brilliance out there, and he sees that there's so much more that must be in existence in terms of the wisdom of what's guiding the world, and he sees also that he's just scratching the surface. So that's a very good lesson. All right, Doug, back to you.
So, I'd like to go back to punishment for just a second.
Yep.
And back to your illustration of a little electronic buzzer zaps you every time you're going to eat something that's not kosher.
Right.
So, that would produce a certain behavior, unless people really like to be zapped. So, that doesn't occur. Yet, it seems like the Torah does emphasize that there is punishment, but it's just that the punishment is deferred. So it's almost like, yes, there's going to be a buzzing zapper, but I'm not going to do it today, I'm going to do it later.
Well, where do we see that that's true, that there's a buzzing zapper?
Well, maybe I need to dig back into the sources, but isn't it generally taught in Torah Judaism that a person is held accountable for his actions at some point, and either it's in this life or in the next one?
Oh, yeah. But then let's say he gets the punishment in the next world. So that's not a zapper. Zapper means at the time that you do something negative, boom, you're hit with it at that moment.
Right. Okay. So if we argue that the purpose of punishment is to change behavior, then if I get the punishment right now, then it would change my behavior. If I get the punishment later, let's say 10 years from now, but in this world,
we don't know that's true. We don't know that God works that way. So I think it's better that we look at the cases of when we actually know God did punish and study that, as to presume, instead of presuming that there are cases, you know what I'm saying? Like, to presume that God punishes 20 years down the road, let's not do that. I don't know if it's true. I think it's...
Well...
The safe approach is, what cases do we have that we can examine?
Okay, doesn't the Torah say that God is slow to anger, and isn't that interpreted as meaning he doesn't punish immediately for actions?
Yeah, in order that perhaps the sinner will repent.
Right.
And in that case, if he repents, he doesn't get punished.
Right.
It actually, Ezekiel says, right, 18, that if a person repents completely, 100%, then God doesn't look at the sin as having ever occurred.
Right.
Okay.
Which makes some logical sense, because if the whole purpose of punishment is to change behavior and the person changes their own behavior, then the punishment isn't known.
Well, again, I still left you a question earlier. Are there other reasons why there might be negativity meted out to people or to a person? We didn't answer that yet. We still have to answer this. I don't agree that punishment is only of one species, that it's only for corrective measure. For example, the babies that were killed by the flood, or the command to kill a Moloch, that includes all children and infants. So that can't be punishment. What must it be then?
Well, if we it would seem like the only possibility would be that there is some positive reason or benefit that those people are killed.
Okay, so... I would agree with that, that there's some positive reason or benefit. There has to be. He's not doing it purely for... God doesn't do anything out of just negativity. That's not the God that we know. He's benefiting man every single step of the way. But it could be, in the case of the flood, that any other future generation that would be born into that people, those people, they had no hope. That's what it seems like. So the infants and everybody are all being wiped out because you have to start afresh now. And there's only 8 people that were saved. So there, you could say a number of people were receiving punishment. And you could say also, at least one more, there could be more reasons. You could say one more reason is that it saves the future generations from falling prey to that society where there's no escape. And that's what God said. He said in the verses, the inclination of man's heart is only evil all day long. So again, if we examine the verses, we can find the reason. So that's what it says in Genesis. I think it's at the end of Genesis that it says that the inclination of man's heart is only evil all day long. And therefore, that precipitated the need for destroying everybody. Because there was no escape. It was only evil all day. There was no benefit in that society whatsoever. So they were all wiped out.
Okay, so let me pause on that one and say, if God looked forward somehow to all the future generations that would come out of those people and say there was no hope for them, then what about the free will of those people?
They had free will, but God knew the future. His knowledge of the future doesn't cause human action. It's different than cause and effect, like Maimonides says. He explains that question. He says it's a big question, but the answer is that God's knowledge is not like our knowledge. Like our knowledge is, if we can see something down the line, that means it has to happen, and there's no way for it to deviate. If I put all these dominoes a half an inch apart, and the height of each domino is an inch, so if I knock one down, every single one is going to get knocked down. It's impossible that one along the way wouldn't. That's because our knowledge is of cause and effect. So we'd say there's no way the dominoes can deviate. But God's knowledge is not out of cause and effect. So even though he knows something's going to happen, he's not causing it, and people still have free will. But he saw that nobody was going to use their free will for the good. Moses did the same thing when he smote the Egyptian. Remember, we discussed that.
He looked into the future. I remember.
Yep, so...
Okay, then I guess one last question. If, for whatever reason, people are punished after this life for things they did in this life, but if it's also understood that, you know, you can sort of accumulate merits or whatever and so forth in this life, but at the end of this life, then you're done, sort of like the game is frozen, you know, and you go forward from there. What is the purpose of punishment after this life if you can't change behavior as a result of it?
Right. Well, again, like the rabbis say, no one knows about the next world except God alone. That's a verse. So we don't understand what's going to happen there. You do have different commentators. I think you take a look at Sadia Gaon in the Book of Beliefs and Opinions. He goes into this matter. Is there a refinement of the soul? Is there some kindness that God does to the soul that had some sins? And in order to have a better eternal existence, he does some sort of modification. It's guesswork. I mean, we'll have to take a look and see. If you want, we can go into it and see if there's any type of indication. But we'll have to, you know, weigh that against the fact that it says, it's a verse that, you know, no eye has seen it except God alone. In terms of the reward and punishment, that for sure is dependent upon a person's level, the good and the evil that they did. When and where are they going to pay the price and get the reward? That's God's determination.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
I remember some years ago I had the same question that Doug had. You know, if there is freedom of choice, then how is it that God knows this ahead of time? And I remember you said to me, like God will have to standing on a building. If somebody would be standing on the building, they could see what's happening on the block before, on the block where they are, on the block after. They can see. They can see what the choices are that's being made. And they know there is freedom of choice.
I don't think I gave that example.
I thought it was. But
The example that I gave is that a weather, a meteorologist who predicts the weather, he's not causing it, but he can tell you what's going to happen. That's just a rough analogy. But God as well, he knows what's going to happen, but he's not causing it. I don't think that should be a problem, because we all know that we have free will. We just stop right now, and we decide, am I going to pick up that cup of coffee right now or not? It's up to me. There's nothing coercing me. So a person knows that he has the ability. How does God know the future anyway? We don't know that. Then we'd be God, like Doug said earlier.
Right. And also the reward and punishment. There has to be punishment. There's no two ways about it. If you have a dollar and you spend 75 cents, you're only going to be left with 25 cents. There's no way of going back on it and saying, well, why am I only having 25 cents? Why am I being punished? It's not even so much a punishment. It's a cause and effect.
Yeah, I think that's what Doug said once also. Right, Doug, about that your life afterwards is going to be a result of where you brought yourself in this life.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, again, it's a lot to be studied. And again, since it's God's ways, we're just going to scratch the surface, just like Einstein said. And, you know, what's true about the physical world is true about, you know, studying justice and metaphysics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Okay. Rabbi?
Yeah, come.
Just curious, with God putting in motion the laws of nature, we have positive and negative consequences depending on whether we work with it or not. Would the negative consequences be considered punishment, or is punishment attached more to a divine intervention kind of thing?
Yeah, the latter. Of course, if a person, you know, he's not careful with a knife, and he's cutting an orange in his hand, and he goes too far, and he slits his hand. So, actually, it's a real case. My friend showed me this 2 weeks ago. He had a scar on his hand, and he was just careless. That's not a punishment. That was self-inflicted. He was foolish. So that's not a punishment at all.
So,
Maimonides, actually, take a look. Let me just finish, Doug. 1 second. I just want to count. If you take a look in the Guide for Perplexed, Maimonides says there are three categories of mishap for man. One is God to man. Another one is, one is nature to man. The other one is man to man. But he says the majority of negativity is self-inflicted. So there's natural negativity that happens to man, like mudslides, which again, if you follow nature, don't build your house on the side of a mountain. So you'll avoid mudslides completely. Man-to-man will be war. And that's why it's important to have governments and to elect, you know, honest people, good officials that have the true sense of justice. But the greatest sense would be self-inflicted. All right, Doug, go ahead. I'm sorry for cutting you off.
No, that's all right. So in terms then of punishment, is there any, because we have the laws of nature, okay, and obviously there are consequences. Even for the evil person who steals and so forth, there are consequences in terms of, you know, what he has to live with emotionally and so on and so forth. And then there's this kind of idea that God intervenes to punish a person. And I guess the question I'm asking is, does that actually happen? Or, except perhaps in the case of God's personal supervision, but for the vast majority of people, are we just living a life based on the consequences of the laws of nature, and we get the consequences of the choices we make within that environment?
No, for sure. For sure that God is involved with a person in the level of his perfection. Maimonides goes into that as well, and he quotes it from the verses in the Torah, and he shows how the higher level a person is, the more God is involved. And he goes through the cases of Abraham and Jacob and Moses and shows how the actual description of God, when he's talking to them, that he's going to be with them, you see there's a more intimate relationship with Moses than he had with Abraham. So, and this is not just for them, this is for all human beings. And this is something, that's why the study of providence is what they were all involved in before the Torah was given. So Rabbi Shady giving a class on it, that Shem, who's the son of Noah and Eber, so they set up a yeshiva. They set up a study hall. And what were they studying? They were exploring God, how he works through the world and man. And they were studying, you know, God's providence. So certainly, you know, and we say it, I am God, I do not change. Those are God's words in Malachi. So if he doesn't change, that means that his method of relationship to man is unchanging. And just like, I mean, that's why the study of the Torah is very applicable today, because he isn't changing. And whatever is true about how he related to these individuals is going to apply equally to a person who would live the same type of a life. We'd have to explore and see. I mean, you see by Esther and Mordechai, there was no overt miracle. But if you look through the entire story, you just see that the timing of how these different events took place that were necessary for their salvation, you see there was divine intervention. So if a person's living properly, like the Talmud says in Brachos, in the beginning, if something negative happens, a person should definitely explore, look at his, see if it was self-inflicted, see if there's some lesson he could learn from it. Maybe this is something which was providential in order to steer him off the wrong path, get him to the right path. Maybe it was something which he didn't do anything wrong, and God wanted to steer him towards greater perfection, so he gave him a new opportunity. So a person can pause and reflect and see what's happening in his life, certainly. That what's, you know, the whole Torah is to understand how God works. A person can repent, and he must repent, and God will be with him in a greater measure. A person can't be, you know, looking for, you don't need the overt miracles to know that that's God. You have a whole system. And if you see things, or maybe things have improved. And when did it start improving? Maybe it was after I made a change, or I corrected a certain notion that I had in my life. You see that Job had a terrible, his body was afflicted and lost his children and his home and his wealth. But once he improved his thinking, he got everything back more than what he had before. So these are lessons, because this is how God works. God doesn't change.
So when we talk about the idea of God's punishment, in our society we think about punishment basically as sort of hitting somebody. You know, you did something wrong, so we're going to hit you, we're going to put you in jail, we're going to whack you in one form or another. But it seems like God's punishment isn't really a punishment in that same sense, but that it's an intervention in order to allow the person to improve. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's what it says. Only those who God loves does he rebuke. Meaning to say that those that are going to pay attention. So therefore, somebody who's on the path to improvement would be the one that's the candidate to receive it. If somebody's not going to listen, he's too stubborn. There are people like that. They're too stubborn, and they're just not going to change their ways, and they've forged out a lifestyle for themselves, and they've become so brazenly arrogant, and this is just so penetrating. You could have that. That was the lesson of Paro. That a person could get so far gone that God holds back their ability to repent. And that was a lesson for all generations, to see that there could be a point of no return. There could be a point where a person sins so grievously that that's it. So that's a scary thing. That's why it's we're lucky to be learning and to be safeguarded against that. But again, with the punishment and negative things that happen, there would have to be a study. We'd have to go through cases and see where God meted out certain judgments, and to understand why did he do it this way in that case, why did he do it to this one person here and five people there, all the different parameters. It's not going to be a small study, but that would be the way we approach it, is to look at all those cases and to start seeing the patterns, whatever small patterns we can see. And again, we'll have questions, but whatever we can make, you know, small steps on, like Einstein said, you know, our feeble minds just see, we just scratch the surface. But that's God's will, that we get to see a certain brilliance. And it is amazing to us, that small amount. Okay. Cal, Doug, are we all right?
Yeah, I was thinking I had one more question, but I've lost it. So, yeah, I'm good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Rivka, also good?
Excellent. Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. If you see that then, and again, we could underscore in the verse 17 that it is the work of God. That's what he calls it. King Solomon calls it. He says, and I've seen all the works of God. So that means what's happening is not outside of God's observation and involvement. When does he step in? When he doesn't step in? Can we know for sure when something is involved or not? Nope. Without a divine miracle, we can't say, you know, that this was definitely done by God or not. In the case of the firm, however, when we see how it was just amazing, the timing, that something which also the timing was the effect by the plagues. So perhaps that from there, we see a parallel, and they had the right to say this was God's involvement, and they were able to make a holiday based on it. But, because that was the whole reason. The plagues themselves, they were natural, but they came about when Moses said they would. So that showed how he had information from God that was being ordained by God. So the timing is what showed the divine, the element of divine divinity in there. Same thing by Purim. Why was it that Esther was chosen? I mean, that's just, there's so many points to that story that were necessary. And the timing. So, it's a study, like any area. Okay, let me see here. Hello? Somebody had a question?
Yeah, I just, when I think of punishment, for me, the one thing that comes up really clear is the Korach, when he went against Moses and the earth just opened up and swallowed him and his family. And to me, I mean, that's not a laws of nature. It seems like that truly is a divine intervention.
That's right. And again, that's a study. Why was that the right response? Because what was Korach's complaint? That Moses and Aaron, they took these positions of leadership to themselves, and really, Korach says, I'm the next in line in terms of the age order, so I should have been the next one to get the priesthood. So he was saying that they were not working by divine direction. So what would be the greatest proof that Moses is following, that he's in line with God? I was thinking that not if God says something and he follows, but let's say Moses says something and then God follows. Wouldn't that be the greatest endorsement of Moses, that God is endorsing him, if God actually does endorse him? So Moses says, but if a regular type of death you have, God didn't send me. But if an unnatural event occurs when you die like no other man and the earth opens up its mouth and swallows you, so then you'll know that God sent me. And as soon as he said that, that's what happened. So it could be very, very well that the very complaint of Korach was God responded to in kind, meaning there's a design why he responded this way. His complaint was that Moses is not following God. He's doing it out of nepotism. He's setting up the priesthood for his brother. So Moses displays how he is following God every step of the way, to the point where even if he suggests something, God now responds. How much more of an endorsement do you need than that? That's the greatest endorsement, that you're following God. If you say something and God says, yes, I'll do it. So you see there that there's just the design of how it took place. Why the Jews had to wander the desert for 40 years? And what was that whole instance? And that they had to eat the manna for 40 years. Every single one of these events has tremendous wisdom that we have to analyze.
So Rabbi, on Korach, so he got swallowed up, clearly at the last second, I guess, as he's falling down into the earth, he recognizes the truth. But his life is over.
Yep.
Now, do the commentators discuss at all, if I think about Elijah when he was going to the people and they set up the two altars and the priests of Baal cried to theirs and nothing happened and Elijah prayed and God came down and or God sent the fire down from heaven to burn up the sacrifice of Elijah. There was a clear demonstration of the people of which way is the right way. In the case of Korach, it seems like that something like that also could have been done, which would not have resulted in Korach's death, so that Korach would have been able to see and therefore, repent and change his behavior. The commentators talk at all about why the death as opposed to just a clear demonstration of who's in charge.
I'm not fluent in that area to comment on that, but I would say just a general rule. You do see that the Torah has levels of severity of punishment. Some are lashes, some is death, some are in different degrees. So depending on the nature of the person, the person can reach a point where his life has no purpose anymore. It could also have a deterrent effect for the others. It could be like the flood where negativity comes to the world in order to pave the way that there's no negative influence anymore for future generations. I mean, why do we kill the infants in the Amalek? There should be no remnant, right? No remnant at all of Korach. You shouldn't say that this is the animal, of Amalek. You shouldn't say that this is the animal of Amalek, because that type of an existence would have the seeds to flourish again. Again, there's many other cases. Abraham did nothing wrong. Why was he told to sacrifice Isaac? Isaac did nothing wrong. Why was he put in that situation? Has to be studied. But in all the cases that we'll find, we're not going to see that God is taking a innocent person and doing something which is a punishment. That won't happen. But that's the whole principle of justice. That God relates to the person on their level. And some people could get to the point, like King David said, Maimonides quotes him in the guide, that people could be so low, they're just like animals, where they're just, only the species is being governed by God. But the individual members, they just left the chance. And that's how you can explain situations like tsunamis, where you have, thousands of people. So if people are completely away from God, or if they're idolatrous, even worse, and then they're just not living in a way where they're relating to the Creator in any measure, so then it's just like animals. Remember Rabbi Chait's brother, Chaim Moser Chait, gave a beautiful article last year. He gave it to us in the, we reprinted it. And he said that if you have a lion that goes after a certain zebra, so are you going to say that this zebra deserved to be eaten and the other zebra didn't? You had two zebras in the field. Why did the lion pick this one? So he didn't pick this one. It wasn't a matter of just there's certain things of chance. So these things are not up to certain merits. And this is a good thing. So you can have people that reach a level where they're like, low-luck animals, and there's just no intervention. There's no merit that they have that God should step in. Just like a zebra has no merit that God will step in and save this one. That wouldn't have any benefit. There wouldn't be any purpose in that. So it's hard for people to hear because they look at all human beings as equal, but they don't understand how God works. They haven't studied it. Once a person gets to the point that they accept, like the reason and truth that there's a creator, and then again, the reason and proof, they recognize there's only one religion that was ever given, and then they recognize this is really God's wisdom, so they'll start studying it, then they can start understanding how it works, and they'll have to slowly start abandoning these infantile emotions of their wishful thinking of how God should work. Many people are really, they're blinded by that. And you hear so many times people say the notion, God just wants me to be a good person. Well, that's not what God said. That would be one sentence. It wouldn't be you know, a book of hundreds of thousands of words, or letters, whatever the count is. So, you know, the wishful thinking is, people are just, they don't use wishful thinking when it comes to the body and medicine. Then all of a sudden they trust the doctor, whatever the doctor says. They won't administer any, syringe into their bloodstream. You know, and they wouldn't just let anybody do surgery on them. They'll make sure, after a lot of research, who's going to be touching their body. So this has to be how a person approaches justice as well. The same level of care. But people don't do it. All right. Any questions or comments? So we'll move further next week. But we'll continue. We haven't exhausted these verses, so we're still going to pick up from 16. We just touched on it today. But I'd like, you know, more time to look into it myself. All right?
All right. Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, my pleasure, everybody. Have a nice day. Good forum to everybody celebrating.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.